This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, June 6, 2007. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Aura Bogado. Democrats narrowly defeat what one describes as a Trojan horse amendment to the Senate's immigration bill. Veterans advocates say homelessness is on the rise among soldiers returning from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And thousands of Cambodian Americans face imminent deportation.
He's not Cambodian. He's an American. And everything that he knows is American culture.
Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. As the G8 summit began today, some 10,000 protesters defied a ban on demonstrating near the summit itself, thereby preventing journalists and even some officials from getting to the resort at Heiligen Dam. Cinnamon Nippard reports.
Anti-globalization protesters have blocked roads and a railway track near the G8 summit venue, and police have used water cannons to try to disperse them. The resort where the summit is being held has been surrounded by a 7-mile-long security fence topped with razor wire. While out to sea, the waters have been sealed off with a net and are being patrolled by warships and helicopters. But as the tension builds on the outside, things are also heating up on the inside, with serious disagreements between the US, Britain and Germany over the issue of climate change. Tensions are also running high between Russia and the United States. President Putin has threatened to target certain European cities with nuclear weapons if plans for a US missile defense system go ahead, and warned of a return to the Cold War era. President Bush responded by criticizing Russia's track record on democracy. Issues like poverty reduction in Africa and economic growth and responsibility in the global economy are on the agenda for the remaining 2 days of the annual summit. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
The Associated Press is reporting that several thousand Turkish soldiers crossed into Iraqi Kurdistan this morning. Unnamed Turkish security officials cited in the AP report say the troops were pursuing Kurdish guerrillas who were launching attacks within Turkish territory. High-ranking Turkish and Iraqi officials have both denied the report. Turkey's military has recently built up a significant presence along its border with northern Iraq and reportedly shelled Kurdish positions earlier this week. The debate of how Turkish officials should handle raids by PKK rebels based in Iraq comes in the context of Turkish elections scheduled for next month. In the UK, civil rights campaigners and even cabinet ministers are sounding the alarm over sweeping new anti-terrorism powers the government wants to give the police. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Since 9/11, the police have already been given new powers several times, and they haven't actually asked for any more. The new proposals would further strengthen stop and search powers, making it an offence punishable with a $10,000 fine for a person to withhold their identity or refuse to answer questions. Police already stop a disproportionate number of black people and what civil rights campaigners refer to as people under suspicion of being Muslim. The Home Office also wants the power to arrest and detain people without charge beyond the already increased 28 days, possibly to 90 days. Cabinet Minister Peter Hain has spoken out.
We've got to be very careful that we don't create circumstances that are the domestic equivalent of Guantanamo Bay. And Guantanamo Bay, which was an international abuse of human rights, acted as a recruiting sergeant for dissidents and alienated Muslims and alienated many other people across the world.
These plans put an end to hopes that some civil liberties might be restored or at least reviewed by Tony Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, who will become Prime Minister later this month. The proposals will be put to Parliament this week. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Mexican public school teachers opposed to reforms to Mexico's social security system for state workers have begun constructing semi-permanent housing out of wood and concrete to reinforce their tent city protest encampment in Mexico City. The teachers have been camped out near Mexico's state pension headquarters for a month now, calling on the government to not implement the reforms passed in March. Mexico City's mayor today warned the teachers to take down the housing structures or face forced removal by police as early as tonight. The Department of Justice is appealing a recent decision to drop all immigration-related charges against anti-Castro militant Luis Posada Carriles. Carriles is a former CIA operative implicated in various acts of violent sabotage, the deadliest of which is the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner that killed all 73 people on board. He is wanted on terrorism charges in both Cuba and Venezuela, but the Bush administration has refused to extradite him, arguing that Carriles could face torture in either country. The only charges he faced in the U.S. were related to his illegal entry into the country, and those charges were dropped last month by the presiding judge, who called the government's investigation outrageous. And finally, the female director of one of the few independent radio stations in Afghanistan has been found dead in her home. Armed intruders shot 35-year-old Sakia Saki at least 7 times as she slept last night next to her youngest child. Saki ran Radio Seoul, or Peace Radio, since its founding in October of 2001. It is the only independent radio station in the Parwan province and includes programming on human rights, women's rights, health education, and issues affecting children. Saki ran a local girls' school in addition to her radio work and at one time was a member of Afghanistan's Loya Jirga. She leaves behind 6 children. The murder comes less than 1 week after 22-year-old television newsreader Sakiba Sanga Amaj was gunned down in her home in what has been described as an act of family-related violence. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
In the U.S. Senate, debate continues on a controversial immigration bill that proposes to normalize the status of some 12 million undocumented immigrants, further militarize the U.S.-Mexico border, and change visa rules in a way that critics charge would split up families. Today, Senate Democrats narrowly defeated a Republican amendment that would bar convicted felons from seeking legalization. It's the latest in a series of Republican amendments that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid described as an attempt to stall or kill the bill. Reid says he hopes to end debate on the bill with a test vote as early as Thursday. If that fails, he says he may kill the bill himself. Republican leaders asked for more time to debate it. Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania.
We can't deport them all. We have a porous border. If we don't have comprehensive immigration reform, we're not going to put up all the fencing. We're not going to put up all the barriers. We're not going to put up all the additional people. The administration has made some commitments, and will there be more about how we'll guarantee that those funds will be spent. We're not going to go through with employer verification. We're not going to spend the money on foolproof identification so that employers can see who is legal and who is not legal, so we have the basis for imposing tough sanctions, including jail. We're not going to eliminate the magnet to bring more people in. It'll be a colossal failure. I think it's safe to say that the United States Senate would be the laughing stock of the country, if after all of the hyperbole and all of the publicity and all of the proposals and objections, we're not able to finish this bill.
The intense conflict over immigration spilled over into last night's Republican presidential debate. Senator John McCain was the only Republican candidate who strongly defended the current Senate bill. Another candidate's sole campaign issue is his opposition to it. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more on the debate.
The 10 Republican presidential candidates appeared on the same stage as Democrats did 2 nights earlier. While Iraq was most concerning to the Democrats, immigration played a central role for the Republicans. Only Senator John McCain defended the Senate legislation he helped to write, and he suggested that his opponents have provided few alternatives.
We need to act, my friends, and if someone else has a better idea, I'd love to have them pursue it, give it to us.
Thank you, Senator. Hold on.
Senator Sam Brownback also supports the bill, if no major changes are made.
And it's better than not doing anything.
Brownback and McCain are the ones who will have to cast a vote on the bill. In a Democratic Congress, a shaky coalition is barely holding it together. The other candidates, most of whom won't cast a vote on immigration legislation before the presidential elections, spoke strongly against it. Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani says necessary tracking systems are missing from the bill.
It does not provide information about who exited the United States. Now tell me how you're going to figure out who's in the United States if you can't figure out who's left the United States.
And former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney thinks the 12 million immigrants currently in the United States should not receive citizenship.
Well, one thing you could do to make it better is to take that Z visa and make it temporary instead of a permanent right to stay in America. That's simply just not fair.
The primary reason Representative Tom Tancredo is in the race is because of his opposition to immigration. He was instrumental in shaping the enforcement-only immigration bill 2 years ago. It aimed to deport all undocumented immigrants. And he'll try to shape a bill in that direction when it reaches the House of Representatives.
We have to stop all legal immigration except for people coming into this country as family members, immediate family members, and or refugees.
Many topics, including immigration, were framed in the context of a national security issue. The Iraq War was another. The only candidate who wants an end to the war in Iraq is Libertarian Congressman Ron Paul. He also vehemently opposed the notion of preemptive war.
Tonight, we hear that we're not even willing to remove from the table a preemptive nuclear strike against a country that has done no harm to us directly and is no threat to our national security.
The candidate who spoke about a preemptive nuclear strike against Iran was Congressman Duncan Hunter.
The United States reserves the right to preempt, and we may have to preempt, that nuclear weapons program. We cannot allow them to have a nuclear device.
Mayor Giuliani says options should not be taken off the table.
Iran is a threat, a nuclear threat, not just because they can deliver a nuclear warhead with missiles. They're a nuclear threat because they are the biggest state sponsor of terrorism, and they can hand nuclear materials to terrorists.
Governor Romney displayed a bit more restraint.
You don't take options off the table, but what you do is stand back and say, what's going on here? You see what's happening in Sudan and Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran. All over the world, we're seeing the same thing happening. And that is people are testing the United States of America.
Religion and abortion were also discussed, only Giuliani is pro-choice. On health care, former Health and Human Services head Tommy Thompson says prevention and wellness must become a focus in the health care system. He also says 10% cuts in the administrative costs would make health insurance more affordable. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Meanwhile, House members are discussing their latest immigration proposal, the STRIVE Act. Immigrants' rights advocates are poring over the 700-page long bill. One of the many issues it does not address is a situation that has put more than 1,000 Cambodian Americans at imminent risk of deportation and could endanger thousands of other Southeast Asian immigrants. Ngoc Nguyen examines their plight in this first story of a two-part series.
Gao Chea's college graduation party was also meant to celebrate the release of her older brother from prison.
I had made the music, the slideshow. It was just really, I had invited everybody. And then 2 months before the party and his release, we found out that he was going to be deported, or he received this deportation order. And my family had no clue what deportation was at the time.
Gao's family had fled Cambodia as political refugees in the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the advent of the Khmer Rouge regime. She was not yet one, and her brother was four when they arrived in the United States in 1981. Gao's parents opened a convenience store and worked long hours to support the family, but had little time to watch over them. Gao's brother's story is similar to that of many refugee children adjusting to life in a new country. When he turned 18, he was arrested for a crime he had committed along with four friends while still a juvenile. But due to bad legal advice, Gao's brother was tried as an adult. His family believed that after he served his time, he would eventually return home as a free man. But in 1996, new immigration laws took effect that allowed non-citizens who were convicted of crimes labeled as aggravated felonies to be deported.
My brother had a green card, and we were political refugees escaping a country that we thought the U.S. recognized as a country of persecution and a country we were fleeing from. And they were embracing us as part of their resettlement program. And so it was unbelievable they would send us back to this very country that they knew we were escaping from.
Joran Lyons, a staff attorney with the Asian Law Caucus, says the problem is that the definition of aggravated felony keeps expanding. Previously, non-citizens convicted of such an offense who served 5 years in prison could be deported without a hearing. The 1996 law lowered the bar even further.
Let's say that I steal a computer and I'm convicted of misdemeanor theft and I'm given a suspended one-year jail sentence. I'm ordered to serve, say, 30 days in the county jail, and the rest of my jail sentence is suspended. So from a criminal standpoint, I only have to serve 30 days in jail. But from an immigration standpoint, if I have a green card and I'm not a United States citizen, I have now become an aggravated felon.
And the law applies retroactively to include people with criminal convictions from before 1996, even if they have already served their sentences in full. Gao says her brother was picked up by immigration officials upon his release from prison and shipped to Arizona, even though there were detention facilities nearby.
For the next 3 years, every single month, they told our family that my brother would be deported in the next month. And they told us this every single month for 36 months. And each day my brother started to lose hope. He started thinking that he might spend the rest of his life in detention.
In 2001, the Supreme Court ruled that a non-citizen who was ordered deported could not be detained for more than 180 days if his or her home country does not have a repatriation agreement with the United States. Lyons says the STRIVE Act has a provision that allows for indefinite detention.
What's alarming about this is that these are people who have served the full sentence for their criminal conviction and are now being held in civil detention for potentially years and years and years because of a political dispute between their country of birth or citizenship and the United States.
When Gao's brother signed his deportation order in 2002, the United States had no repatriation agreement with Cambodia. However, a few months later, the countries signed one. Currently, 1,400 Cambodian Americans are under deportation orders. 126 have already been deported, including Gao's brother.
He's not Cambodian. He's an American. And everything that he knows is American culture that he's been raised under, and what we've created in him is an American kid, and they send him back.
Immigrants' rights advocates like Gao want due process restored in deportation cases and reentry for those who have already been deported. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nok Nguyen in San Francisco.
That was the first of a two-part series on immigration policy, deportation, and Cambodian Americans. Tomorrow's story will examine the situation of those already in detention. The National Coalition for Homeless Veterans is holding its annual convention in Washington this week, where participants are discussing what they say is a growing number of American soldiers who find themselves living on the street after returning from Iraq or Afghanistan. The Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that 400,000 homeless vets lived on the street last year. As many as 10,000 of them have served in wars launched by George W. Bush. Aaron Glantz reports from Los Angeles.
U.S. Vets West Side Residence Hall is a hulking eight-story structure a few blocks away from Los Angeles International Airport. It's the largest transitional housing and employment center for homeless veterans in the country, housing 700 veterans annually. Gregory Hull is one of them. The 31-year-old staff sergeant enlisted shortly after high school and served in Bosnia, Cuba, Kuwait, and Afghanistan before being severely injured in Iraq in 2003.
I was hit by an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, and I suffer from compression of the spine. I used to be 6'4", now I'm 6'2 and a half. I got knocked through a wall.
The Veterans Administration considers Hull to be 100% disabled. He walks with a limp, dragging his feet with each step he takes. He also suffers from mental problems, bipolar disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorders, conditions he didn't have before he went to Iraq. Hull says his problems really started when he got back to the United States and started using methamphetamines to dull the pain.
The pains of losing loved ones in the battlefield, the pain of not being there for my children, the pain of not knowing how to live in this society, you know. I always stuffed things down, you know, deep inside, and I never really wanted to deal with them because I consider myself a hardcore guy, but after the effects of the methamphetamine went away, I still felt the same, you know? And it wasn't, no matter how much I could do or how much I could smoke, the results were the same, you know? It was the insanity of it all.
Hull has four children, age 7, 4, 2, and 1, but his behavior since being released from the military has kept him away from them. In addition to using drugs, he started dealing them as well. Since leaving the military in 2003, he has served time in federal prison in Oklahoma for felony home invasion and has had numerous other run-ins with the law. Within 3 years, he hit rock bottom, one of 27,000 homeless vets on the streets of Los Angeles. Dwight Radcliffe is Chief Operating Officer of U.S. Vets.
I think the recently separated veterans that we're seeing that are homeless, you know, a lot of them had problems prior to even going into the military. So their family of origin issues that never get addressed, they get exacerbated while in military service and then afterwards. And I believe that there's not a solid transition to support systems when the veteran comes back.
Rachel Feldstein is Associate Director of New Directions, a residential care center for homeless veterans inside the VA complex in West LA. She says veterans of the Iraq War are becoming homeless much quicker than Vietnam vets.
These are folks who are coming pretty much straight from deployment to the streets of LA, living on the streets of LA, getting seriously addicted to drugs and getting involved in criminal behavior very quickly.
While about half of the estimated 400,000 homeless veterans served during the Vietnam years, Feldstein says most didn't become homeless until a decade after their discharge.
What's unique about the men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan is that they are not able to integrate with their family. They've seen horrible things, they've been in horrible places, and they can't relate at this point. So that's one of the issues that we're dealing with, is the family issue. It's very strained. So that and then you become homeless in the place that he last lived.
Activists concerned about increases in the number of homeless veterans argue for greater federal investment in affordable housing and social services. Of particular concern are long waits for mental health care, which can run as long as 6 months. In addition, a recent study by Harvard's Kennedy School of Government found that by the time the Iraq and Afghanistan wars end, there will be at least 2.5 million vets. Because of that, the Harvard study concluded, Congress will have to double the VA's budget simply to avoid cutting services. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Los Angeles.
State governors in Nigeria's Niger Delta region have asked the Nigerian government to release Asare Dokubo, a militant leader facing treason charges. Dokubo's release is also a demand of militants whose activities have forced Nigeria to cut its oil exports by as much as 25%. Samuel Lukoya reports from Lagos.
Alhaji Asare Dokubo, leader of the Niger Delta Volunteer Force, has been in detention since November 2005. He is facing treason charges on account of his armed rebellion against the Nigerian government and oil companies operating in the Niger Delta region. He could face the death penalty if found guilty. In the last year, armed militants have stepped up attacks on oil installations, forcing Nigeria to cut its oil exports by more than 500,000 barrels per day. Last week, when he was sworn in as Nigeria's president, Umoru Yar'Adua said he will work towards finding a solution to the crisis in the region.
We will involve all stakeholders in working out a solution. In the meantime, I appeal to all aggrieved communities, groups and individuals to immediately suspend all violent activities and respect the law. Let us allow the impending dialogue to take place in a conducive atmosphere. We are all in this together and we will find a way to achieve peace and justice.
Militants in the Niger Delta want local communities to have a share of the region's oil resources. They also want the government to release Alhaji Asare Dokubo from prison. His campaign against the Nigerian government and Western oil companies operating in the Niger Delta made him popular among local people. Many see his release as part of the solution to the crisis. Pat Eneyo, a youth from the Niger Delta, is one of his admirers.
Alhaji Asare delivered us from our suffer. We suffer a lot. So he came in to shorten our weapons. He's a God-sent person, so he delivered us.
Governors from the region say they have met the newly elected president to discuss the possibility of releasing the militant leader on health grounds. The governors said following their meeting with the president, they are positive that a solution will soon be found to the crisis in the Niger Delta. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The G8, the world's seven industrialized democracies plus Russia, kicked off its annual summit in Germany today. One of the items on the table for discussion, a commitment that G8 member states made in 2005 to spend at least 0.2% of their national budgets on initiatives to end poverty in the world's poorest nations. As Joshua Chalimpa reports, however, not a single G8 member has met that commitment.
The group of eight industrialized nations meeting in Germany this week is expected to make fresh pledges to increase aid to Africa and end poverty here. But a report by the South Africa-based group Africa Monitor says the G8 aid to Africa has actually fallen over the last 2 years. Some say it is high time the African nations ignored the G8 and charted their own development path.
Truly, there is little or nothing that Africa can benefit from the G8 summit, because we should first look at the origins of the G8. How did the G8 start about?
Godfrey Sali, a researcher at the Africa Center for Research and Development.
This was just an informal meeting of the wealthy tycoons in Europe and America. It was just an informal meeting whereby they sat and started having a chat that how do we solve Europe's problems? How do we solve America's problems, not Africa's problems?
Sali says the G8 is not accountable for its promises of assistance. Sibo Amada, a lecturer in business administration at Makerere University in Kampala, takes a softer line. He says that despite the figures, Africa has benefited from the G8 assistance since the Glasgow summit.
Very little has been done in terms of giving funds as such, but on the other hand, there are some things, though there are few, which have really helped some Africans, like the debt cancellation, fighting against HIV/AIDS through the Global Fund, and on the area of peace and conflict. G8 countries have been really giving a help to African countries.
Richard Edwards of the British Department of International Development defends his government's record on increased aid. Edwards says G8 members are accountable to their taxpayers, so they will only fulfill their promises if there is full accountability by countries receiving aid.
It's clear the G8 has made lots of promises over the years. Well, as I was saying, and one of the most important things is for people here to see how they can make efficient uses of the resources provided.
Edwards says Africans must hold their own governments accountable. He was meeting journalists in Kampala who have been facilitated to cover the G8 summit in German by the UK-based non-government organization PANOS.
In terms of my own agency, I know that we are committed and UK's government aid budget is increasing. But I think the debate here was very clear. Lots of people felt that citizens have to be lobbying with their government to demand effective use of services so that, for example, with HIV/AIDS, the right level of services are provided to the people who need it most.
Klaus Hoberdon, a German diplomat in Kampala, says that Africa is simply being ungrateful to the G8 because they have invested a lot in fighting suffering on the continent.
That is all fighting for poverty when you're providing the people with clean drinking water. That is the best thing for fighting poverty. What more or less the people is expecting, capacity building. That is something which has to be intensivated, that more or less investors are coming up, creating jobs. That is a step which has to be properly organized.
The issue of Africa and the G8 is one which will continue to generate debate here. While G8 members may feel they are doing Africans a favor by giving aid, some Africans believe the G8 is obliged to help the continent because its members are beneficiaries of the exploitation of the continent's natural resources through slavery, colonialism, and now globalization. In this context, some observers argue that the G8 will be forced to increase aid to Africa in future, not out of concern for the continent, but in order to compete with new players like China, which is vying with established industrial nations for the abundant natural resources on the continent. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa in Kampala, Uganda.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Turna Guse and Monica Lopez produce our newscast. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. In Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Auto Bogato.